as the disaster in Vietnam unfolded these last days, I found myself thinking of all those countless years of high-level meetings among the experts, the generals and the strategists, the political experts, supply people, the intelligence people. I thought of all those costly intelligence reports. I thought of all of those expensive think tank Rand Corporation research studies which had made possible this disaster. You know, policy can be too sophisticated by far. And what has been conspicuously lacking in our policy towards Southeast Asia from the very beginning was some good old-fashioned common sense and a basic moral sensitivity. Somehow we assume that with all of our wealth and all of our computers and all of our sophisticated technology and of all of our academic know-how, we would be able to make events in Southeast Asia conform to our will. And when everything else failed us, our money, our weapons, our knowledge, we decided that 500,000 American soldiers would be able to do the trick. Of course, the result has been from beginning to end a crescendo of the tragic, disastrous. I have a feeling that a great deal of the responsibility for the tragedy, which is Vietnam, lies at the feet of the fascination of our society, or at least of those who lead the society, with our ingenious tools and our subtle methods of analysis, the whirl of the computer, the range of the high-altitude camera, the feedback from experts in the field. We seemed always to be asking how, what now, when, who, how much, instead of asking the basic question, the simple question, why. We seemed always to assume that our skill, our wealth, our power, our resource, human and otherwise, would be able to make right the increasing wrong. At first, we were confident that our training and technicians would turn the South Vietnamese army into an efficient fighting force. And when this proved a futile undertaking, we decided that what was missing were some sophisticated weapons. And so we provided faster planes and cannons with longer range and the so-called smart bombs. And when this failed, we decided that we should interdict the supply lines of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. And when that failed, we decided we ought to strike at their sanctuaries in Cambodia and at Hanoi and Haiphong. And on, and on, and on. After every disaster, there was a contingency plan, some way out. Never were we willing to ask the question, why were we there in the first place? Somehow we avoided the very thing we Americans say we're so strong in, pragmatism, horse sense, basic moral concerns about human values. What we had was tactics. What we needed was a basic principle. Now, even those who were convinced that we ought to go along with the Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson administrations at the beginning of this tragedy, Even they were never quite sure why we were there. It was simply that there was still that tie of faith between the American people and administrations, which made us feel that somehow, if they told us it was right for us. We were there. We ought to see it through. From the very beginning, no one in Washington or otherwise was able to make clear to us why, what we were doing there. They were never able to sell to the American people the proposition that the corrupt and feudal junta in Saigon was a clean living democratic society which ought to be saved from communism. They were never able to make clear precisely what they meant by national interest, except that there were certain American corporations and certain American geopoliticians who believed that there would be new markets and new naval bases if we succeeded in having our way. And the tragedy of Vietnam for the American people, as opposed to the tragedy for the Vietnamese, is that it has broken that tie of faith between us, the citizenry, and administrations, Democrat and Republican alike. We no longer trust the experts, the State Department, the administration. We're no longer willing to say to them, somehow you know better than we do. And if we don't understand why our national interest is involved in Africa or Latin America or Southeast Asia, and you tell us it is, that's enough for us. And if Gerald Ford can do nothing now but play Nero, that is, play golf while South Vietnam burns, the reason lies in the fact that the American people, through the Congress, have dug their heels in and have essentially limited the ability of the administration to throw good after bad, to involve itself, us, in Vietnam or elsewhere in the globe. And there is tragedy in this, for America does have, obviously, political involvements, national interest at stake in many places throughout the globe. And the mulishness with which we as an American people are digging in our heels and saying to the president, no more. A mulishness which is a direct reflection of our non-understanding of national policy may inevitably make it impossible for the administration to do things which ought to be done, to make commitments of power which need to be made. The United States today is in the position of an unclawed, defanged paper tiger. We have power, the greatest power in the hands of any nation on the face of the earth, and we cannot use that power even when it might be legitimate to use it, because we are confused people, because we have been lied to and manipulated by five administrations. And we have determined that unless someone makes clear to us precisely what our national interest is, precisely why we ought to be involved here or there and not there, precisely why this feudal dictator is our ally and that populist government is our enemy, until someone makes clear to us the dimensions of American involvement and commitment throughout the world, no more. Secretary Kissinger is an intelligent and able man, but he plays his cards very close to his vest. And the problem is that he conceives of himself in the role of Metternich, the great Austrian statesman of the 19th century, man of brilliant subtlety and diplomatic skill. But what Dr. Kissinger forgets, and what all his predecessors forgot, is that while Metternich had simply to satisfy the Austro-Hungarian emperor and no one else, an American president and secretary of state must satisfy the American people. And that unless and until they do, there will be more restrictions and more votes against foreign aid, and more votes for the limitation of our armed forces overseas, and more unwillingness to be involved a greater and greater expression of what's been described as the growing isolationism of America. It's not that Americans are by nature isolationist. It's that we've been used and misused and manipulated, and we're saying no more. Not until we understand. Not until it's made clear to us. Now, the Secretary of State has ordered a massive reassessment of American foreign policy, and it's, I'm sure, called for. But it's a tragedy the way it's being carried out. It's being carried out by those who were not able to see the forest for the trees in Vietnam over the last 20 years, and it's being carried out behind closed doors in secrecy. And again, there's that sense that the American people cannot be trusted, and we're not to be told. We're to be spoon-fed what the government wants us to think. And I would submit to you that the American people is far more intelligent and far more able to work out its destiny than any administration since the Second World War has been willing to admit. Who are those whom Secretary Kissinger summoned as a special cabinet advisors? The Bob McNamaras and the Dean Rusks of the Johnson-Kennedy years, who told us only with a little more efficiency and a little more application of money and power would we have things solved in Vietnam. The George Shultzes and the George Balls of the Nixon Ford years. All of them men. Men who didn't ask why. Men of subtlety and sophistication. Men who could not or would not ask the basic questions. And how is this new assessment of foreign policy being carried out by the experts away from the American people? Not in terms of a great public debate over the national purpose, but there's to be a massive reassessment, and when it's finally decided, President Ford will tell the American people through the media what they want us to believe. And the American people, I would submit, are no longer buying. And in that, there is the seed of terrible, terrible disaster. For power must be used. There must be the freedom for those in power to exert American influence when it needs to be exerted. We live in a world of thrusting enemies. And if we have power and cannot use it, we are powerless to defend ourselves. But what other way can the American people vote, demand, insist upon partnership in our national destiny? It's our lives and our money. And we want to say, not simply to be public related, and told. As I listened to my neighbors and friends these last several weeks talk about Vietnam, I sensed guilt, vague sense of guilt for what was involved. I sensed shock. But most of all, I sensed a terrible sense of misunderstanding. They didn't know why it was happening. How could it all have come unstuck so quickly? And you know, it's really very simple. We got involved in a feckless adventure in Southeast Asia. And as the costs mounted, we developed a group in the United States which grew in size, which was demanded the withdrawal of American men and American support from Vietnam. It called itself a peace movement, but it was really simply a movement to get America out. And finally, the pressures could not be withstood by the administration, and they jerry-built a so-called peace treaty of Paris in January of 1973, which was not a peace treaty for Vietnam again, but Americans wanted to be told it was a peace treaty. It was nothing more than a way to organize the effective withdrawal of American troops, the return of American POWs. That's what we got. And the North Vietnamese and the Popular Revolutionary Government, the Viet Cong, got us out. And the South Vietnamese, who had no alternative but to accept what America was willing to do, at least got the control of the territory which we had won for them, and some kinds of assurances, we're not quite sure what, of continuing support. It was a ceasefire in place, a ceasefire that wasn't obeyed from day one. Oh, there was all kind of conversation in print at the Paris Accord that there ought to be negotiations towards a joint government in Saigon of the Viet Cong or the Popular Revolutionary Government and the Q regime. And there was talk about some ultimate meeting of North and South Vietnam looking forward towards reunification. But none of this was ever brought into play. There was to be a joint military command to overlook the ceasefire. But when the North Vietnamese came south to be part of the joint military command, General Q quarantined them to Tan Sanh Air Base and never got off the air base. And when the South Vietnamese went to the Viet Cong areas to oversee the ceasefire, they were quarantined to the huts that the North Vietnamese wanted to quarantine them in. There was no attempt to live up to the ceasefire. The first month, in January of 1973, 2,000 men were killed in battle. Immediately after the Paris Accord, General Q began a series of mopping up operations in the south, particularly in the Mekong Delta, trying to clear areas which were still infested with Viet Cong. And after a good deal of success at this, he began to launch brigade and then division level attacks in the highlands and towards the north. No one was quite sure why the North Vietnamese were not making an effective response. The answer seems to be that they had assessed the situation and were regrouping. They had built new fast macadam roads south. They had built new oil pipelines to the south. And they had transformed themselves from a guerrilla army into an army which was more conventional, prepared to fight for territory with guns and tanks and the like. And when they were prepared to strike they did, and effectively so. Now, the American people were told in January of 1973, because they don't read beyond the headlines, that we had a peace agreement. And because very little was reported from Vietnam in 1973 and 1974, somehow the death of 150,000 Vietnamese in battle in those 2 years isn't very much newsworthy. We suddenly woke up one morning and found that the defenses of the South Vietnamese had crumbled along the coast and in the highlands, and we were facing this disaster. The administration, again, had misled us, deliberately and consciously. Again, we had been told what people wanted us to believe, that things were better than they are, not what they seemed. More and more, the American people have tuned out the administration, tuned out Washington, turned in on their own problems, and the result may be catastrophic for our nation. This isolationism, the result, means ultimately that one by one, our allies are deserted. One by one, our commitments are not picked up. And little by little, China, Russia, the Third World moves in and controls the markets, the national resource, the free societies on which our security, to a very large measure, depends. One of the tragedies of these last days is not simply that a particular policy in Vietnam has turned to ashes, or that a particular bit of shuttle diplomacy in the Middle East was aborted, or that there is danger that part of the NATO defense system, particularly Portugal, will opt out and weaken. The danger is that America is moving towards paralysis. And this movement is a result, a direct result, of 20 years in which you and I have been consciously and deliberately misled, misinformed or non-informed about the nature of the world as it is, of American commitments such as they are, and of the reasons why we ought to be involved. How long has it been since we had a national debate on foreign policy? How long has it been since someone got up and said to us, here's our world. This is what it's really like. This is what we conceive to be the major concerns of the United States. These are our allies, and these are the reasons that they are our allies. These are the commitments which we have made openly and honorably Will you back us up in them? Instead, there are secret negotiations, cards played close to the vest. None of us quite understand what is involved. Once we had a Cold War. There were the good guys and the bad guys, the black and the white, but at least we thought we understood. And the Cold War somehow became something else. We began to thrust against each other the superpowers through our allies in Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Iraq and in Israel and elsewhere, Southeast Asia. And now we've moved into a system which is called détente. Now, to the diplomats, Brezhnev, Kissinger, détente means simply a continuation of the complex struggle for economic and political advantage which is part of the world since day one. But to the American people, détente has been sold as a period of relaxation. The Cold War has thawed. We can turn to our domestic concerns. We no longer need to be so involved with matters overseas. Russia and the United States will learn to get along. There's going to be trade. Trade's the new messiah. Somehow the nations that trade together will live together in some kind of security. Americans like to think of trade as a panacea. We're a nation of traders. But you know something interesting? The high point of trade between the United States and Germany came in the years 1913 and 1939. And the two greatest trading powers in Europe in the decade before the First World War and in the decade before the Second World War were France and Germany. There's no guarantee that trade makes compatible political bedfellows. Americans have been told that things are getting better, that we have détente. And as a symbol of détente, the Americans and the Russians get together for armed limitations agreement. And then suddenly we read in our papers that the Vladivostok agreement, far from limiting arms, actually increases the ability, the capacity of both superpowers to overkill the world. There'll be more missiles and not less, more warheads and not fewer. Is it any wonder that Americans are confused? We're told that we must learn to trade with the Soviet, with China. And so we're prepared not only to send wheat, but to send complex computers which can guide missile systems to the Soviet Union, all in the name of détente, in the name of peace. But at the same time, we're being told by our experts that Russia is equipping Syria against our ally in Israel, Iraq against our ally in Iran, that she's investing a great deal of money in Syria and in Algeria, building naval bases to undercut NATO to the south. She's bringing pressure on the new military junta in Portugal to give her a naval base there, that she's already established a naval base in Conakry in West Africa. And we read about Soviet arms going to the Eritrean Liberation Group in order to cut off the Red Sea to make it a sea controlled by the radical Arabs and by Soviet allies. And then we read, if we read carefully, that the entire ability of the North Vietnamese to change from a guerrilla army to a conventional army has been subsidized and underwritten by Russian equipment. 850 new, powerful Russian tanks are rumbling ahead of the North Vietnamese army as it moves down the isthmus. The new Russian shoulder anti-tank missile, which wreaked such havoc during the October War, is being used in Southeast Asia. Where is détente? Is it any wonder that the American people are confused? We're being told conflicting things. Whatever we're being told, we don't know how to put it together. And we certainly suspect that it isn't quite the truth, because no one has bothered to tell us the truth for the last 20 years and more. Now, Dr. Kissinger is fond of assuming that the world is a complex entity, that there will never be peace, that there are only degrees of temporary balance and tension between nations. And he's right. We live in a complex world, in a shrunken spaceship Earth. And there are reasons to trade with our enemies, and there are reasons to keep up our guard against our enemies. But if detente is a fact, let it be explained to the American people for what it is, and not merchandised for what it is not. If it is simply the continuation of confrontation policy by other means, let us understand it as such. And let us not be told by Washington that it means that there has been a thaw, that there's less danger. Perhaps there's even more. From Portugal to the Middle East, from Latin America to Southeast Asia, it's quite obvious that American policy is in disarray. I, for one, am not as concerned for the immediate losses. I speak now as an American citizen purely, as I am for what the future portends. Because what I see developing here in America is a growing unwillingness on all of our parts to assent to whatever the government proposes. Having been treated for two generations like children, we are reacting in childish ways. They propose and we say no. They say do and we say we won't. I'm not sure how else we could react. How else we can make known to Washington that we demand a new deal, honor, and truth, and openness, and forthrightness, and being treated like adults rather than as children. What we need now more than anything is not Gerald Ford being presented a speech which he reads to the American people, which doesn't tell us as much as it tells us. And we do not need now what Senator Mansfield is proposing, a new bipartisanship whose terms we don't understand. What we need is a great public debate. We need to find a new consensus. We need to be brought into the policy process. We need to find the ways through our legislators and otherwise to insist that this in fact comes into being. Otherwise, I foresee America stuffed to the gills with guns and planes that we cannot use, making commitments to Iran, to Israel, to other nations we have no intentions or ability to make good on, and then being very angry with such nations when they don't trust us. American power is a fiction because it cannot be used. The American people live in a troubled and thrusting world. And some want us to believe that it's far more secure than it really is. Our world is interdependent. And there are cruel and brutal forces out there which must be confronted at the cost of lives sometimes, at the cost of committing ourselves to unpopular causes. But we're not prepared to do so because we don't understand. My plea to the government is to be taken into the process, to be told the truth, and not to be fed slogans. What are we seeking to achieve? What are our legitimate national interests, and what are the limits of our power? What have we promised 100 and some odd nations around the globe? What haven't we promised? Where do you propose to go from here, and how do you propose to get there? By strange coincidence, these last days I have been reading with my class at Case Western Reserve the text of the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah lived 2,600 years ago, at a time not unlike ours, a time of great change and world politics. The great imperial superpower, the Assyrians, were being broken from within and from without. And there was, as there is today, a joint high command, a foreign ministry in Jerusalem, all giving sophisticated advice to the king as to how he ought to manage his imperial, his national interests. Join the Egyptians and you'll be given foreign aid. Join the Babylonians and you'll be given military support. Whatever you do, find this policy, follow this policy or that policy, and it'll give you territory or money or soldiers or power. And one king after another during Jeremiah's lifetime followed the sophisticated advice of his generals and strategists and his foreign ministers. And one king after another lost his life in battle, saw his army destroyed, cities taken, and finally the capital, Jerusalem, in flames. And during watching all of this, Jeremiah was moved to say in the name of God, "Let not the wise man boast of his wisdom. Let not the strong man boast of his strength. Let not the mighty man boast of his army. But if he would boast, let him boast of this, that he knows and understands me, that I am the God who works mercy and justice and righteousness in the earth." There is a fundamental thrust to the affairs of men. There are fundamental needs within the community of men. A policy which is sensitive to those needs and to this fundamental movement of time, nations, may succeed, can succeed. But a policy which is simply one designed to impose our will must fail. We are a people of good sense. We can't claim to be an informed citizenry. We need to be informed. We need to be allowed to use our good sense in determining what we will do, what we'll be committed to, and what sacrifices we are prepared to make. And I'm afraid that until that openness and that honesty re-enters our American political system, one tragedy will follow another. Because the American people will not follow those who will not inform us. They will dig in their heels, and turn away, and not give their taxes or their support. And even when a president ought to be free to exert his power, he will find himself tied up, circumscribed, bleating out as President Ford had to bleat out at his press conference Thursday last. "Please, dear ally, trust us. We are still a people of will and of power, and we'll exert that will." The world doesn't follow sheep who bleat. Allies cannot trust weak leaders whose people do not rally behind them. We need a new national strength, and that can come only from national unity. And that can come only from a new way of going about the forging of policy. Will it come about? I doubt it. We're too used to the closed doors. There are too many public relations people designing the speeches that are being made. The personality of Dr. Kissinger is not inimical to openness. But it'll come at some point. As disaster piles upon disaster, someone will lead. You'll find a great following. I pray it will not come too late. Amen.